Real quick, we have to take a break to acknowledge the sponsor of today's episode, which is Secret Nature. Secret Nature's ultra premium CBD gummies are crafted with real botanicals, nothing extra, and designed to fit right into your day with clean, purposeful functionality. So for me personally, I like to take one of their snoozer gummies in the evening to unwind and ensure that I get a good night's sleep. After a long day, especially when my brain is just still running a mile a minute and I can't seem to settle down, I'll take one to help me slow down, unplug, and actually get a good night's sleep. I personally don't drink alcohol because I just don't like the way it makes me feel the next day, but these gummies feel very clean, intentional, and it never leaves me groggy the next morning, just feeling balanced and rested. Secret Nature's gummies are organic and farm grown. They're never lab made. They're ultra premium CBD gummies made with real botanicals and nothing extra. You've got two purpose built options. There's Bliss for clear focus and productive flow if you want to take one during the day, and then you get Snoozers to help you relax and rest at the end of the day. Each gummy has consistent, measured CBD, so there's never any guessing, just clean, reliable functionality that fits naturally into your schedule. Get 30% off your first order at secretnature.com with the code MAMA. That's M-A-M-A. And just a heads up, their Black Friday sale is coming up, and they are going to be offering 25% off on orders of $75 or more, 35% off on orders of $125 or more, and then 40% off on orders of $150 or more between November 26th and the 30th. So don't forget to use my code MAMA when you check out. That's M-A-M-A at secretnature.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
This MLB season, FanDuel's Dinger Tuesday is back. And this year, all customers get a profit boost to bet home runs every week. So gear up to go yard all season long on FanDuel, America's number one sportsbook.
21 plus and present in select states. Opt-in required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable profit boost tokens. Restrictions apply, including any token expiration and max wager amount. See full terms at FanDuel.com/sportsbook. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly. And before we get started with today's case, I have a couple little housekeeping things I want to address. So this case came to us in the form of an anonymous request on our website, mamamystery.com. So thank you for that. If you want to request a case, you can go to that website and let us know. The second thing is that Wicked Women, my first book, is coming out on May 31st. You can find it on Amazon, available for pre-order. This is a collection of 11 stories about women who have committed heinous crimes. And I've told many of these stories on the podcast, but there's one bonus chapter of a story that I have not told, which is that of Eileen Wuornos. One thing I haven't really shared on the podcast before is that Eileen Wuornos's case always kind of fascinated me as I was watching true crime documentaries as like a kid. Growing up, you know, I've always talked about Casey Anthony being really influential in my like true crime interest, but Eileen Wuornos is like right up there with her for different reasons. I just always found that whole story to be so fascinating. There's been multiple documentaries made about her case with cameos from Eileen herself giving interviews, and she's just really fascinating to watch because she's so unlikable and brash and rough around the edges. And so she was kind of like a car crash that you're passing by and like you shouldn't look, but you can't look away. So anyway, that is coming out on May 31st. The second or third thing I want to talk about is CrimeCon. If you're interested in going to CrimeCon, it is going to be in Denver this September, and you can save about 40% or $40 off of your ticket by using the code MAMAMYSTERY at checkout. If you have thought about going but just don't really know what it entails, go to crimecon.com to kind of just check out past events and what
those I've included to kind of get a taste of what's usually there. It is a huge event. There are always, there's always something to do. There's always exhibits in various rooms throughout the convention center. So there's always going to be something that will likely pique your interest. And then there's Podcast Row, which has a ton of podcasters, YouTubers, just true crime creators there. So you get to meet some of your favorite people, including me. Now, last thing before we get started, I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for choosing to listen to Mommy Mystery. You have so many podcasts to choose from, and it is really, really hard to grow a podcast, especially nowadays when we're so inundated with choices. And I've noticed that we've garnered a lot of new listeners lately. So if you are new here, I want to thank you. And if you've been here from the jump, I appreciate you so much. When you share on your socials that you're taking a walk or driving or cleaning while you listen to Mama Mystery, it makes me feel so grateful to be a part of your life, even in that small way. So thank you so much. And know that every time I see those posts, I smile so big. And if I could kiss you on the mouth, I would. That's from my favorite comedian, or one of my favorite comedians, Leanne Morgan. Okay, let's get into today's story. Today, we are talking about the case of Roger Keith Coleman, who was accused of an unthinkable crime, the rape and murder of his own sister-in-law. He fought for years maintaining his innocence in the courts and in mainstream media, so much so that he made the cover of Time magazine. But would DNA testing prove or dispel his claims of innocence? And when the results finally came in, would it be too late? This is the case of Roger Keith Coleman. Roger Keith Coleman grew up in the small coal mining town of Grundy in southwestern Virginia. He was a lifelong resident of Grundy and even worked as a coal miner himself. However, Roger Coleman's youth was complicated at best. He had a history of sexual misconduct dating back to his early teens. In 1972, at just 13 years old, he was brought before juvenile court for making obscene phone calls to female classmates. By 1977, at age 18, Roger's behavior had escalated when he attacked a local woman named Brenda Reif at gunpoint and attempted to rape her after tricking his way into her home under the guise of helping with flood cleanup. When Brenda let him inside, he pulled out a gun and ordered her to go up to her bedroom, tie up her six-year-old daughter, and then undress. When she refused, he tore open her bathrobe and threw her on the bed, climbing on top of her. But Brenda fought back, scratching him on the neck in the process, and then managed to escape with her young daughter. Roger chased them and tried to force them back inside, but she was able to grab Roger's gun from him and throw it under the porch while she was screaming for help, alerting the neighbors, who then came to help her. Roger Coleman was later convicted of attempted rape, serving about 2 years of only a 3-year sentence in that case. After his release in 1979, Roger's reputation only worsened. In January of 1981, he allegedly exposed himself and masturbated in front of two librarians at the Buchanan County Public Library. One librarian even sketched the man's face and identified him as Roger Coleman when he was arrested later, although no charges were ever filed for this specific incident at the time because the police blew it off as if it was some sort of prank. The librarian recalled that she was working late on a cold night in January, and the library was quiet and about to close when a man walked in through the front doors with his pants unzipped and he was actively masturbating. He locked eyes with her and then walked up to the desk, ejaculating on the desk before leaving. Stunned, the librarian called the police, but when they got there, they acted like this was just a prank for shock value, like a flasher. The librarian insisted this was more than that. She remembered the deviant, sociopathic look in his eyes, but police refused to properly investigate, so no charges were ever filed. Locals who knew him were very wary of him. By early 1981, he was seen as a young man with a pattern of sexual deviancy and violence. And only 2 months after the incident at the library, Roger Coleman elevated his crimes to a whole new level. On the night of March 10th, 1981, 19-year-old Wanda Faye McCoy was brutally attacked in her home in Grundy, Virginia. The crime was especially violent and shocking. Wanda was raped, stabbed in the chest, and slashed across the neck with such force that she was nearly decapitated. When her husband, Brad McCoy, returned home from work around midnight, he discovered Wanda's lifeless body lying in a pool of blood on their living room floor. Her sweater had been pushed up and her underwear was partially removed, devastating signs of the sexual assault that she had suffered. The shock in the small town of Grundy was immediate. With a population of only about 1,300 people, Grundy was the kind of place where people didn't even lock their doors, but that changed after Wanda's murder. The sheer brutality of the killing left residents terrified that a killer was on the loose. As one account noted, people began to lock their doors at night, and no one expected to sleep well until after the murderer was finally caught. Wanda herself had been quite shy and nervous. In fact, she had been receiving obscene phone calls in the year prior, which had made her especially jittery and cautious with strangers. But this detail would later take on an added significance as police started piecing together who might have targeted her. Wanda McCoy's murder wasn't just a shocking crime. It was personal to Roger Coleman, because Wanda was family. She was his sister-in-law, and the investigation soon revealed that whoever killed her likely got into her house without forced entry, suggesting Wanda had willingly let her attacker inside. This immediately put those close to her under the microscope, including Roger Keith Coleman. The police investigation into Wanda's murder kicked off under intense pressure to find the culprit. Early on, detectives observed no clear signs of forced entry at the McCoy home, which indicated Wanda probably knew her attacker and let them in willingly. Wanda's husband, Brad, told police that his wife would only open the door at night to a handful of people she trusted. Given Wanda's recent fears from obscene phone calls and her naturally cautious nature, it made sense that the suspect pool was limited to people that she felt safe with. Investigators interviewed a few individuals, and suspicion quickly centered on Roger Coleman, Wanda's brother-in-law. Several factors made Coleman a prime suspect almost immediately. First, as a relative, he had easy access to the house, and Wanda would have likely let him in without hesitation. Second, Coleman unfortunately had the misfortune of having a record and lacking a convincing alibi, as Time magazine would later put it. Police learned that on the night of March 10, 1981, Coleman had reported for work at the coal mine but left early after his shift was canceled for the evening. This meant he was potentially free around the time of the murder, and he couldn't provide a clear, airtight alibi for that crucial window. Third, Coleman's criminal record spoke volumes. His prior conviction for attempted rape made him stand out when investigators considered who in town might be capable of a sexually motivated killing. In a small community, everyone knew about his past troubles. Physical evidence from the crime scene added to the case against Roger, though it was largely circumstantial at first. Key findings included a fingerprint on the front screen door, and investigators tried to determine if it belonged to the perpetrator. There was also a pry mark on the door frame and blood stains inside the house. Now, that pry mark is going to come in later, so keep that one in mind. But Wanda's body and clothing yielded further clues. Her fingernails were broken, and she had cuts and defensive wounds on her hands, indicating that she fought back. Additionally, her body had a dark, powdery dust on it. Now, mind you, Roger's mining work often left coal dust on his clothing, so that dark, dusty substance raised eyebrows about a possible link to him. Perhaps the most damning forensic detail at the time was that tiny flecks of blood were found on Roger Coleman's pants, and tests showed that the blood was the same type as Wanda McCoy's. But you have to remember, this is pre-DNA era, so blood type matching was far from conclusive, but it was enough to deepen their suspicions. By early 1981, roughly a month after the murder, authorities felt they had enough cause to officially arrest and charge Roger with the rape and murder of Wanda McCoy. The arrest didn't exactly surprise many locals who were following the case, given his past and the investigative findings. Many had already suspected him. Yet despite the mounting evidence and gossip around town, Roger Coleman insisted on his innocence from the moment that he was accused. He cooperated with police to an extent and maintained that he had nothing to do with Wanda's death. It would be up to a court to determine the truth, setting the stage for a contentious trial that would soon follow. Roger Coleman's trial for the rape and murder of Wanda McCoy took place in 1982, about a year after the crime. The trial was held in Buchanan County, Virginia, and it attracted considerable local attention given the horrific nature of the crime and Roger's claims of innocence. Over the course of a four-day trial, the prosecution and defense presented two very different narratives of what happened that night. Prosecutors, led by Commonwealth's attorney Mickey McLaughlin, laid out a straightforward theory that Roger Coleman attacked and killed his sister-in-law Wanda, and the evidence, though circumstantial, pointed squarely to him. They emphasized several key points in their case: the fact that there was no signs of a break-in, which supported the idea that Wanda willingly let her killer into the house, Prosecutors argued that this meant the attacker was someone she knew and trusted, such as her brother-in-law, rather than a random stranger. His past conviction for attempted rape was also highlighted to show a propensity for sexual violence. Introducing his criminal history was a way to suggest to the jury that Roger was capable of such a crime and had done something similar before, even though it wasn't as violent. Also, a strand of hair found on Wanda's body was microscopically similar to Roger Coleman's hair. Additionally, the blood flecks on his jeans matched Wanda's blood type. And while neither of these proved guilt conclusively 100%, taken together, they painted a picture that Roger Coleman was at the scene. The state also noted that semen recovered from Wanda's body was consistent with Coleman's blood type. And you just have to remember that type matching was the extent of forensic testing available back then. Then, perhaps most dramatically, a jailhouse informant claimed that Roger confessed to the murder privately while he was in jail. This alleged confession, if believed, could be powerful evidence. However, jailhouse testimony is often controversial because a lot of times prisoners will say something if they think it'll help them get a leniency on their own sentence. Now, using these points, the prosecution painted Roger Coleman as the only person who had the opportunity, the access, and the prior behavior consistent with the crime. They argued that the combination of forensic clues and his own background left little doubt about his guilt. One prosecutor later remarked that it was a horrible murder and rape and that, quote, if there was ever a case for the death penalty, this was that case. The defense, on the other hand, tried to sow doubt about his guilt by highlighting what they saw as inconsistencies and gaps in the state's case. His attorneys raised several counterpoints, one being that contrary to the prosecution's claim, the defense pointed to that pry mark that was left on the front door frame as evidence that someone might have broken in, and if a stranger forced their way into the house, then that undermines the idea that Wanda let her killer in willingly. This detail suggested the possibility of an unknown intruder rather than an invited guest. The defense noted that early forensic tests on the semen sample indicated the possibility of more than one person's involvement. Now, this is a bit technical, but back then, they could test semen for blood type markers, and the results might have hinted at traits not solely attributable to Coleman, leading the defense to argue that another man could have been involved in the rape, or at least that the forensic evidence wasn't a single person match. This raised the possibility that if Coleman was innocent, perhaps the real killer, or an accomplice, was still out there. Prosecutors had initially suggested Wanda might have been caught off guard with minimal struggle since she likely knew her attacker, but the defense emphasized that Wanda had defensive wounds, cuts, a bruise, broken nails, consistent with a fight, and they used this to question the prosecution's narrative. If Wanda fought violently, could her attacker have been a stranger after all? Or at least the defense argued it wasn't as calm or straightforward an encounter as the state implied. But this take is pretty wild to me because if someone is attacking me, whether I know them or not, I'm using as much force as I can muster. To suggest that I might use less force to fend off someone who's trying to rape and murder me because I know them, that is offensive and just insane. The defense also presented affidavits from several witnesses, presumably to support his character, provide some form of alibi, or cast doubt on key prosecution timelines. For example, Coleman had claimed an alibi. He said he was at home reading on the night of the murder, if recalled correctly from some reports. But perhaps some witnesses tried to corroborate seeing him or other suspicious individuals. And these details of these affidavits weren't heavily publicized, but the defense wanted the jury to see that there could be more to the story. Now, despite the efforts by the defense, the evidence against Coleman, though circumstantial, appeared compelling enough to the jury, and after a relatively short deliberation of only 3 hours, the jury returned with a verdict. Roger Keith Coleman was found guilty of the rape and murder of Wanda McCoy in the first degree. With the guilty verdict, the trial moved to a sentencing phase. Given the heinous nature of the crime, a rape and brutal murder of a teen girl coupled with Coleman's previous felony, the jury opted for the death penalty. In April of 1982, Roger Coleman was formally sentenced to death for capital murder. Roger, for his part, was devastated by the verdict. He continued to declare that he was innocent, telling anyone who would listen that a terrible mistake had been made. As he was led off to death row, the legal battle was far from over. In many ways, this was just the beginning, shifting from the trial to a lengthy appeals process. Look, I love true crime more than probably most people, but what I don't love is when I get so deep down the rabbit hole of a case that it just keeps me up at night. And before I know it, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning. And when that happens, I naturally would wake up feeling so groggy and like I need 10 cups of coffee just to ensure that I don't crash. Enter Beam's Dream Powder, because when it comes to solving the case of your sleepless nights, Dream is a lifesaver. Dream is made with a powerful blend of all natural ingredients, including reishi, magnesium, L-theanine, apigenin, and melatonin. It's designed to help you fall asleep, stay asleep, and then wake up feeling amazing. And unlike other sleep aids, there's no next day grogginess, just great restful sleep. My focus and energy came back, and I felt like I could tackle life head on instead of just trying to get through it. And I'm not the only one. Beam has already improved over 17.5 million nights of sleep, helping people across the country wake up and feel their best. And here's the twist. Beam is giving my listeners an exclusive offer of up to 40% off their best-selling Dream Powder. That's right, up to 40% off to finally crack the case of your bad sleep. Go to shopbeam.com/mama and use the code mama at checkout. That's shopbeam.com/mama and use code mama for up to 40% off, because better sleep, that's the kind of mystery we can solve. Okay, so you've heard me rave before about ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic, and now I have super exciting news because their team just released another product to help get more fiber into your diet without changing what you eat. Fiber diversity supports a balanced gut microbiome, and yet only 5% of Americans get enough fiber in their diet. And if you're like me, it's probably because it's so hard to do. That's why I started using sugar-to-fiber probiotic mix every day. The PhD microbiologists over at ZBiotics understand that 95% of Americans don't get enough fiber. So they genetically engineered a probiotic drink mix called Sugar to Fiber. Sugar to Fiber turns sugar in the foods I eat into a prebiotic fiber called Levan fiber. It's really hard to get Levan from a typical diet, and it helps improve the amount and diversity of fiber that my body receives. Sugar to Fiber is actually taking something that I'm already eating and changing it to a different route, like a healthier outcome, and I don't have to add something new to my routine. Every day, I just put a sugar to fiber packet into my water bottle, and I love knowing that I'm supporting my gut health with this routine. As I get older, gut health becomes more and more important to me. I just turned 37, and I'm already feeling all the like aches and pains of just getting closer to that midway point to where I'm over the hill. I can't even talk about it, but as I get closer to that milestone, I feel like I really have to start taking care of my body because it's the only body that I have. So as I get older, gut health becomes more important to me, which is why I'm adding ZBiotic sugar to fiber to my daily routine. It helps me know that I'm getting the diversity of fiber that my body really needs. Go to ZBiotics.com/mama and use code mama at checkout for 15% off any first-time orders of ZBiotics probiotics. ZBiotics has a 100% money-back guarantee, so if you are unsatisfied for literally any reason, they will refund your money, no questions asked. Thank you so much to ZBiotics for sponsoring today's episode. Once on death row, Roger Keith Coleman embarked on a long and convoluted appeals journey through the state and federal court systems. Throughout this process, which spanned the 80s into the early 90s, he never wavered in claiming that he was innocent. His fight became as much about procedural hurdles as about actual evidence, and it highlights how challenging post-conviction relief can be, especially in a capital case. His first step was the Virginia Supreme Court, which in 1983 heard his direct appeal of conviction. That appeal was denied, meaning the state's highest court upheld his guilty verdict and sentence. He then sought review by the United States Supreme Court, but in 1984, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the case. With the direct appeal route exhausted, Coleman turned to what's called habeas corpus, which is a way to challenge unlawful detention by raising constitutional issues. Coleman filed a state habeas corpus petition in the Buchanan County Circuit Court, raising a number of claims, and often these include things like ineffective counsel or new evidence or constitutional violations at trial, etc. The court even held a two-day evidentiary hearing to consider his claims. However, in September of 86, the state court denied all Roger Coleman's habeas claims and entered a final judgment against him. Now, this was a significant setback, but worse trouble came shortly after when his legal team attempted to appeal that habeas corpus denial to the Virginia Supreme Court, but they missed the filing deadline by only 3 days. Virginia law requires notice of appeal within 30 days, and his notice was filed on day 33. Now, this seemingly small clerical mistake had enormous consequences. It procedurally barred him from further state appeals. So in legal terms, Roger was now in procedural default because his lawyers blew a deadline. Through all these legal maneuvers, Coleman never stopped asserting his innocence. He wrote letters, he gave interviews, and he sought help from anyone who might listen. One significant scientific development gave him a glimmer of hope, which was DNA testing. In 1990, while his appeals were still ongoing, available DNA technology was used to test biological evidence from Wanda's case. Now, the result was not a clear exoneration. Rather, it indicated that Coleman was within the 2% of the population who could have been the source of the semen evidence found at the crime. Some experts noted that combining the DNA result with the blood type analysis made the odds of someone else being the perpetrator extremely low. One figure even suggested a 0.2% chance of another match. The 1990 DNA testing implicated Coleman further instead of clearing him. So, like, why would you even bother doing that if you knew deep down you were guilty? Like, what did you think the results were really going to be? But despite this, Coleman and his supporters pointed out that 2% is not 100%. There was still uncertainty, and he clung to that to argue that the tests did not definitively prove his guilt.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. It's the ultimate bundle for an unbelievable price. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. Get it and watch Marvel Television's Ironheart on Disney Plus.
I want to build something iconic.
A new season of The Bear on Hulu.
We can make people happy.
And the epic, a Minecraft movie on Max.
Anything you can imagine is possible.
The Disney Plus Hulu Max bundle. Plans starting at $16.99 a month. All these and more now streaming. Terms apply. Visit DisneyPlusHuluMaxBundle.com for details.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So as he ran out of legal options, his case became less about courtroom arguments and more about pleas for mercy and public support. By 1991, after the Supreme Court shut the door on his appeals, Coleman's execution date was on the horizon. The only thing that could stop it would be executive clemency, essentially a pardon or commutation by the governor of Virginia. And so the stage was set for a very public campaign to save Roger Coleman's life, with Coleman himself as the loudest voice declaring that an innocent man was about to be executed. As Roger Coleman's legal appeals dwindled, his case began to attract national and even international attention, transforming from a local crime story into a high-profile debate about justice and the death penalty. Coleman's unwavering claims of innocence made him a compelling figure to many anti-death penalty advocates, journalists, and even celebrities. By the early 90s, a full-fledged public relations campaign was underway to argue that Coleman's conviction was a mistake and to plead for clemency. Several key players drove this campaign. One was Centurion Ministries, which was a nonprofit dedicated to overturning wrongful convictions led by Jim McCloskey. McCloskey took up Coleman's cause in the late 80s and became one of his biggest advocates. Another major force was the Washington, D.C. law firm Arnold & Porter, particularly a young attorney named Kathleen or Kathy Behan, who had been working pro bono on Coleman's case since 1984. Kathy and her colleagues understood that the court of public opinion might be the only one left that could make a difference. Together, Jim McCloskey and Kathy Behan reached out to numerous media outlets and even high-profile figures, determined to shine a light on potential flaws in the case. Their efforts paid off dramatically. Coleman's story started appearing everywhere. He was featured on major TV programs like Good Morning America, Larry King Live, Nightline, and The Today Show, telling his side and asserting his innocence. Newspapers and magazines ran in-depth pieces. The New York Times and The Washington Post covered his case, and famously, in May of 1992, Time magazine put Roger Keith Coleman on its cover. The cover featured Coleman's photograph with a provocative headline and bold red and white text that said, "This man might be innocent. This man is due to die." That issue, dated May 18th of 1992, was just 2 days before his scheduled execution. Coleman even managed to get personal appeals from globally renowned figures. It's reported that Pope John Paul II and Mother Teresa both made pleas on his behalf, urging that his life be spared. Now, it's not every day that a death row inmate in rural Virginia garners the sympathy of a pope and a saint in the making. In Grundy and across Virginia, the media frenzy was unprecedented. Journalists descended on the small coal town. One local reporter recalled that around the prison on execution day, there were about 100 television cameras, whereas normally an execution might draw only a handful of press crews. One reporter said, quote, "They thought they'd found the poster boy for wrongful convictions on death row." To many death penalty opponents, Coleman was the ideal symbol, a possibly innocent man who might be executed due to procedural technicalities and circumstantial evidence. His advocates argued that if Roger Coleman's life could be spared and his name cleared, it would prove a point about the flimsiness of the death penalty. However, this public campaign was not without controversy. The local prosecutors and law enforcement who convicted Coleman recoiled at the narrative being spun. Buchanan County Commonwealth's attorney McLaughlin, who prosecuted Coleman, and his team felt that Roger's champions were ignoring or downplaying the very real evidence of his guilt, as well as completely overlooking the other victims of Coleman. They pointed out that people like Patricia Hatfield, one of the librarians that Coleman had traumatized in the beginning, were hardly ever mentioned in the rush to portray Coleman as this wronged man. To those who believed Coleman was guilty, the media portrayal was frustratingly one-sided. Prosecutor Tom Scott joked that with all the publicity, he thought that he was Time's Man of the Year, highlighting just how unusual it was for an accused murderer to receive such sympathetic coverage. Meanwhile, the pressure on Virginia's governor at the time, Douglas Wilder, kept mounting. His office was inundated with pleas for clemency, and he reportedly received 13,000 calls and letters from people around the world, nearly all urging him to stop the execution. It was clear that executing Roger Coleman would not happen quietly. The whole world was watching by May of 1992. As the execution date neared, Wilder made a surprising decision to secretly test Coleman's claims of innocence in one more way. He arranged a last-minute polygraph test for Coleman. Now, this was a highly unorthodox move, quietly done in the final hours. Coleman agreed to take the polygraph. After all, he always maintained that he had nothing to hide. And the result, however, unsurprisingly, did not go in his favor when he failed the polygraph. Polygraphs are not admissible in court for their unreliability, but to Governor Wilder, this was a significant blow to Coleman's credibility. With the polygraph results in hand and not made public at the time, Governor Wilder saw no compelling reason to intervene. The courts had spoken, and now the clock was running out. Despite the massive public campaign and Coleman's personal pleas, the execution was set to proceed. Supporters held vigils and gathered outside the prison, hopeful for a last-minute miracle, but nothing and nobody came. In the early hours of May 20th, 1992, with all appeals exhausted and clemency denied, Roger Keith Coleman was led to the execution chamber at the Greensville Correctional Center in Jarrett, Virginia. He was 33 years old. Outside the prison, a mass of media and protesters stood by, a level of attention rarely seen for an execution, underscoring just how Coleman's case had become a focal point in the death penalty debate. Virginia's method of execution at the time was the electric chair. Coleman had actually been given a choice between the electric chair or lethal injection, but like many Virginia inmates of that era, he ended up in the oak chair that had been nicknamed Old Sparky. As the execution hour approached, Coleman was prepared for death. One poignant detail is that he shared his final meal with Jim McCloskey of Cinturon Ministries, the very man who had fought so hard to save him. This act showed the close bond that had formed between Coleman and his supporters. Even in his last hours, Coleman was in the company of someone who believed in him. When the time came, Roger Coleman also made a final statement, and it was a powerful one. He continued to assert his innocence until the end, and his last words included, quote, "An innocent man is going to be murdered tonight. When my innocence is proven, I hope all of America will realize the injustice of the death penalty as all other civilized countries have," end quote. He then addressed his words to his loved ones, and especially a woman named Sharon. Her name is Sharon Paul. She's a college student who had become his girlfriend through correspondence while he was in prison, saying, quote, "My last words are to the woman I love. Love is eternal. My love for you will last forever. I love you, Sharon." Those gathered to witness reported that Coleman was calm and composed as he spoke, resolute in his professed innocence. Shortly thereafter, at 11:28 p.m. on May 20th of 1992, Roger Coleman was executed by a jolt of high-voltage electricity, followed by a lower-voltage current to finish the job. The execution was carried out without any reported complications. Coleman was pronounced dead, and his body was removed from the chamber. For Wanda McCoy's family and the prosecutors, this moment was the lawful punishment for a horrific crime. For Coleman's supporters, it was a nightmarish scenario. They believed a man with very real doubts surrounding his guilt had just been put to death. The media swarm reported on the execution across the country. Many articles noted the irony that just 2 days before, Coleman had been on the cover of Time magazine with the headline questioning his guilt. Governor Wilder, who had agonized over the decision, stated that he was satisfied that due process had been observed. Still, in the aftermath, Wilder said he took no joy in the execution, but had found no grounds to stop it. Coleman's execution did not mean that this was the end of his story. Almost immediately, his team and journalists turned their attention to the lingering question that he himself posed in his final moments. Would his innocence someday be proven now that he was gone? The case of Roger Coleman was about to enter an unprecedented phase, post-execution DNA testing. After Roger Coleman was executed, his supporters and many in the media were determined not to let the question of his guilt or innocence die with him. The early 1990s were a period of rapid advancement in the DNA forensic science realm, and by the late 90s, tests far more sophisticated than those available in 1990, when Coleman was first DNA tested, had become the standard. If biological evidence from the 1981 crime scene was still preserved, it could potentially yield a conclusive answer about whether Coleman was the perpetrator. Thus began a remarkable effort to conduct DNA testing on an executed man's case, which was something that was almost unheard of at that time. In 2000, Centurion Ministries, which was Jim McCloskey's group, along with several newspapers, including the Washington Post, pushed for new DNA testing on the semen evidence from Wanda McCoy's rape and murder. This was part of a broader trend. In fact, around that same time, a court in Georgia had for the first time ordered DNA testing in the case of a man, Ellis Wayne Felker, who had already been executed for rape and murder. Felker's results in 2000 turned out inconclusive. In Coleman's case, the advocates had to go through the legal system to get permission, since Coleman was no longer alive, to petition on his own behalf. They essentially sued the state of Virginia for access to the evidence, arguing that the public had a right to know if an innocent man had been executed. However, in 2002, the Supreme Court of Virginia denied the request to test the evidence. The court was not convinced that there was a legal basis to reopen a closed case of a deceased convict. This denial was a setback, but the campaigning continued. The Washington Post ran an editorial in 2003 noting that few executions in modern times have proceeded in the face of stronger claims of innocence than Mr. Coleman's, and it directly appealed to the governor of Virginia to allow DNA testing. At that time, the governor was Mark Warner. Warner was aware of the Coleman case's notoriety and the calls for clarity, and after some deliberation and likely considering both the public interest and the precedent it would set, Governor Warner made a landmark decision. In January of 2006, he ordered the DNA testing of evidence in Roger Coleman's case. This made Virginia the first state to voluntarily conduct DNA testing in a case after the defendant had already been executed. In Felker's case, it had been court-ordered, whereas Warner's actions were voluntary. It was an extraordinary move, described by one legal expert as seeking the truth using DNA technology not available at the time the Commonwealth carried out the ultimate punishment. The biological evidence, which was the semen sample collected from Wanda's body in 1981, was sent to the Center of Forensic Sciences in Toronto, Canada. They chose a Canadian lab in part because Canada has no death penalty and would have no stake in the outcome, and this was meant to silence any critics who might claim a Virginia or a U.S. lab could be biased. For a week, everyone waited on pins and needles, and on January 12th of 2006, the results were announced. The DNA test conclusively confirmed Roger Coleman's guilt in the rape and murder of Wanda McCoy. Coleman's DNA matched the semen from the crime scene. According to the scientists, there was only a 1 in 19 million chance of a random, unrelated person having the same DNA profile. Governor Warner stated that the testing reaffirms the verdict and sanction in the case. Virginia had not executed an innocent man. This outcome was both a relief and a blow, depending on who you asked. For Wanda McCoy's family, the confirmation brought a sense of closure and validation that justice had indeed been done. For death penalty supporters, the Coleman case became an example that they could point to and say, see, even the most celebrated innocence case turned out to be guilty. The system worked. For Coleman's supporters and death penalty opponents, the news was devastating. Many of them had truly believed in Coleman's innocence. They had spent years championing his case as a miscarriage of justice, only to find out that the man they rallied behind was, in fact, the perpetrator. The director of the Innocence Project, Peter Neufeld, while praising Governor Warner for pursuing the truth, remarked that, quote, the real issue is not whether one man was guilty or innocent. It's that the governor set an example of what the other 49 governors should do in cases where executed inmates' DNA might still be tested. In other words, regardless of the Coleman outcome, it is crucial to use science to verify these old cases whenever possible. Jim McCloskey of Centurion Ministries, who had spent nearly two decades asserting Coleman's innocence, had to grapple with the harsh reality of the results. Privately and publicly, he expressed profound disappointment. In one interview years later, McCloskey admitted, quote, to this day, I wrestle with did Roger do this or did he not? I don't know, end quote. So even with the DNA evidence, some of Coleman's staunchest allies found it hard to completely reconcile the man that they knew with the crime that he committed. It's a testament to how convincing Coleman had been in proclaiming his innocence, perhaps even to himself. Roger Keith Coleman's case remains one of the most significant and discussed true crime stories in modern American history, not just for its dramatic twists and media attention, but because of what it came to symbolize in the debate over capital punishment and wrongful conviction. Decades later, people still reflect on the implications of this case, and it continues to be cited in discussions about the death penalty. One major point of debate centers on the death penalty and the risk of executing the innocent. For years, Coleman was essentially the face of that issue, a man who many believed was innocent on death row. I mean, you have the Pope and Mother Teresa and Time Magazine and New York Times. Everybody is talking about this story and this man who might be innocent. And death penalty opponents argued passionately that executing him would be an irreversible, grave injustice. In fact, some activists quietly hoped that if Coleman were proven innocent after his execution, it would provide undeniable evidence that the death penalty can kill innocent people, potentially leading to reforms or abolition. However, the outcome, which was...
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
As his confirmed guilt forced a reframing of that narrative. Death penalty proponents seized on the results to argue that the justice system, while not perfect, had worked in this case. An actually guilty man was convicted and executed, and all the appeals and scrutiny still pointed to his guilt. They used Coleman's case to bolster the claim that it's extremely rare for an innocent person to be executed, implying that concerns about wrongful execution might be overblown. This certainly dampened some of the momentum that abolitionists might have gained if the opposite result had occurred. Now, personally, I think Coleman's case also remains a cautionary tale for innocence advocacy groups, especially right now, as Scott Peterson's legal team, as most of you know, the LA Innocence Project continues to fight for his innocence, and they're trying to introduce new evidence, new testimony, all these things. And that's still ongoing. And of course, I'll keep you up to date on that. And we've done a couple episodes on it already. But it showed that sometimes a very convincing narrative of a wrongful conviction can turn out to be false. And obviously, when it comes to Scott Peterson, I'm kind of on the line with that one. I hate to say it because I know it gets people riled up, but I honestly do see both sides. And in cases like this, I think it's worth testing extra evidence just to solidify either side, to prove at least one of the sides right. Like, what harm could be done by just testing more evidence to prove a claim or a theory? I see a lot of parallels between these cases because, except with the Scott Peterson case, nearly everybody thinks that he is guilty, even though most of the evidence is circumstantial, whether you like it or not. There's no DNA evidence that points directly to Scott Peterson as the murderer. But if there is evidence in this van that could point to the potential that someone else did it, then wouldn't you want that tested? I mean, even if it proves your theory wrong, the embarrassment and the heartbreak of being wrong about Coleman was a tough pill to swallow for many well-intentioned people. And the same could be true for the Scott Peterson case. As for the Scott Peterson updates, I'll probably include updates on my weekly docket series. So check those out, because in those episodes, I just kind of briefly recap the top stories in the true crime space for that week. So whatever news comes out about Scott Peterson, I'll be sure to report on it there. But that is all for today's episode. I want to know what you think about this story, and I will leave you with this question. In regards to this case, and maybe even the Scott Peterson case or other cases that are similar to it, Roger Keith Coleman passionately claimed his innocence right until his execution, so convincingly that thousands of people believed him. So knowing now that DNA proved his guilt, what does this case tell us about our own biases, the way that we perceive guilt and innocence, and how easily we can be persuaded? If you're listening on Apple, you can leave your response in the form of a review. If you're listening on Spotify, you can leave it in the form of a comment. You can always reach out to me on Instagram or at mamamystery.com. That is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening. Share this episode if you thought it was thought-provoking or if you enjoyed it. Thank you so much for your support. I'll see you next week. Stay vigilant, stay curious. Mama Mystery out. Bye.